You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Wednesday, February 6th, 2019, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Cara Santa Maria.
Howdy.
Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
And Evan Bernstein.
Good evening, friends.
Steve.
Yeah.
Have you read the news?
Have you read the news today? Oh, boy.
the goop news.
Oh, goop boy.
News. More goop.
Yeah, like, goop
this
news.
This is not good because one of the, like, my favorite things is Netflix. Like, but Netflix is doing a docuseries. Goop is producing a docuseries on Netflix, a wellness docuseries.
Goop, yes. As in Gwyneth Paltrow's lifestyle and wellness empire.
To me, it does not evoke wanting to do positive lifestyle things.
Yeah, like, I agree.
Goop is a gross word.
I think that's part of the idea. It's kind of hipstery where, you know, it's not a polished...
Where she's like, just put this goop on your face.
Yeah.
It's good for you. Well, you know, I mean, here's the thing. Netflix is not a... It's a fire hose. We know this.
Yeah.
And yes, it's something... It's a little more to say that it's Netflix produced, you know, because not all of their... Most of their content is actually acquired, but they do have a massive production arm and it's ramping up and up. There's a lot of crap on Netflix. If you really start to dig through the docuseries and the documentaries, you're going to find stuff that is not skeptic approved.
Yeah. This is different in a sense because, first, it's brand new. You know, it's not like some legacy thing that they did 5-10 years ago.
Was and again, Netflix another, 10 years ago?
Yes.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure, yeah.
Well, remember, Netflix was a movie delivery service, right?
With DVDs? Oh, right. They gave the DVDs.
Wow. They had the kiosks.
Oh, my gosh.
Old
I
school. Right? Oh, DVDs. We should explain that to the audience. What those were.
So I would like to think that this company that produces amazingly good content would, you know, be steering away from stuff like this. But this kind of resets my calibration on where I level them. Elise Lonin, who is their content officer at Goop, said that these are going to be 30-minute episodes that are going to utilize experts, doctors, and researchers to examine issues relating to physical and spiritual wellness.
Haven't they already come under fire for, like, just saying stuff is legitimate when it's not? Wasn't there some issue where they had to remove articles or – you guys remember this? Or issue some big apology, put a big disclaimer that said, like, this is not actual medical advice, and be like, oh, yeah, now we're actually going to produce something with a bunch of experts. Who's going to be – well, we know who's going to be willing to go on those shows.
I anticipate it's going to be this hybrid of some legitimate things mixed in with absolute craziness.
Well, yeah, that's why,
and nobody's going to be able to discern what's what.
Yeah. Exactly, Ev. It's going to be the spectrum of some legitimacy with, you know, complete crap, and your average viewer just won't really know what the big difference is.
Yeah, it's a bummer. It's
already a $250 million company.
Well, and see, this is why Netflix is doing it, right? Yes, where does the buck stop, and at what point do I think we need to be making more kind of ethical decisions about these kinds of things? But as long as it makes a company like Netflix money, they're going to choose to air it.
Sure. Bottom line in this
case. So the problem is that people are buying this crap.
Yeah.
You know, yeah, that's the real problem.
The fact is, alternative medicine nonsense, the whole wellness industry, which is built 99% on total bullshit. It's all about the money, and there's billions of dollars in it. Nothing's going to change that. And as long as that's the case, there's no stopping it. All we could really hope to do is, you know, on the one hand, educate the public so that they're a little bit more critical thinking and scientifically literate. And two, you know, we do need to advocate for effective regulations to at least prevent fraud and, you know, the real harmful stuff. But crap like Goop, I mean, you know, we just have to ridicule it and hope that people listen.
You think they're going to do a vaginal jade egg episode?
Yeah. Oh my gosh, that'll be the most watched episode.
I know.
Figure, you know.
That's terrible. I mean,
for many
vaginal
reasons.
J egg? What's that?
Jade.
Yes.
Don't make that mistake.
and the vaginal and steaming. Oh, maybe after this goes to air, there could be like a counter docuseries called like Poog, and then it's just people like oh, what's her name? Dr. Jen? I can't remember. Gunter and other experts to just like tear it all apart scene by scene. That'd be cool.
Right. Fact checking. Sure.
All right. Well, we have some interesting news items lined up. Jay.
Yeah.
So do you think that Robin Hood really existed? After your exhaustive research, what was your conclusion?
I mean, that's a good question. It's also a hard question and probably impossible to really answer. Partly because, you know, when you get historical figures like this, you know, Robin Hood isn't just a fun story, but there are stories about Robin Hood, and there is even some reports of people using the name and things like that, which I'll get into the details. So how do you answer the question? The question is you have to kind of be okay with not knowing what the absolute truth is and always defer to the experts. You know, I think some people may have been expecting me to say, you decide. And you know what? Don't you decide. Listen to what the historians have to say and you know, pick a few of your favorites and see what they think about this. So who is Robin Hood? Well, you know, I mean, most people know that Robin Hood is a literary character, a character in the movies. There's been quite a few Robin Hood movies out in the last 20 years. But what is the most accurate version of Robin Hood? Well, you know, all of them are accurate because we could do whatever we want with these characters. But when you go back in history and try to figure out, well, what was the origin of this whole thing, things get really interesting and a little muddy. So his origin is kind of similar to the version of who we know Robin Hood to be today. I would say that the earlier versions of Robin Hood were darker. He was not such a good guy. There was like a gray in his character. You know, the green and brown wearing, hooded, bow wielding, you know, fighter of the poor is our modern version, but you know, it's
you
really
mean fighter
cool.
For the poor?
Fighter for the poor. Yeah, sorry. Yeah, you know, the swinging around in the trees and, you know, taking money from caravans that happen to be passing right underneath where they live and stuff like that. That's our modern version of it. So Sir Walter Scott penned Ivanhoe back in 1819. I'm sure that many of you have heard of Ivanhoe. This story takes place in England during the Crusades around 1194. And a character in the book named Locksley was later revealed in the book to actually be Robin Hood. And his title is the King of Outlaws, the Prince of Good Fellows. The character was actually loyal to the king, to King Richard, and he came across as an honorable Englishman. A lot of people will think that this is the first reference of Robin Hood. Nope. 1819 actually is a very modern concept of Robin Hood, much more like the version that we have. This goes back very, very far. You know, from Robin Hood's beginnings, he always did fight against authority, and he always had a crew. He always had companions. The names Merry and men. The yeah. styles and all that come into focus as the years go by. But historical records show, if you want to get back to like what were the real people references to Robin Hood, there were people supposedly who lived that may have started the whole thing. The historian Joseph Hunter, he found several mentions of people who fit the bill. So back in 1226, a Yorkshire court register mentions land that was being seized by a man named Robin Hood, who is described as a fugitive of Berkshire. And then another mention in 1261, a man named William, the son of Robert Le Fier, and a member of a band of outlaws in 1262, a man called William Robehood in Berkshire, who probably was the same guy, right? So 1261, 1262, two mentions with the similar names in the same area was probably the same person. And then we have another one in 1354. So we fast forward quite a bit. Up to Northamptonshire, we find evidence of an imprisoned man named Robin Hood. He was being held for an upcoming trial. And multiple historians agree that because of all the references to Robin Hood, it was probably a nickname given to many different kinds of outlaws. Like, hey, that guy's a Robin Hood, you know, maybe that type of thing.
So it's like the Dread Pirate Roberts.
Right, exactly, Steve. It passed through three people, right, by the time Wesley got it. So, you know, that's why the origin right there, when you think of real people, you know, maybe this first guy, maybe, who knows? But we just don't know. There isn't enough physical records. The best one, I think, is the landowner, because owning land was, you know, was and is a very serious thing. Like, there is paperwork that goes along with that that's very managed by local government and things like that. So I would tend to trust that type of paperwork. But then after that, we just get into oral tradition. So these are taken from poems and ballads, evidence of, you know, that Robin Hood – you know, again, like he always had friends. One of his first friends was a character like Little John, like a brawny type of person, but the character wasn't named Little John. around the 16th century, Lady Marian was also added to the mythology. And then we get up to Friar Tuck came around in 1475. And he started out as a corrupt clergyman who liked to drink, which is kind of similar to the Friar Tuck that we have today. But, you know, I think he was a little bit more corrupt. Oh. And even one of his foils, the Sheriff of Nottingham, is also present in the earliest versions of Robin Hood. Again, these are the oral tradition versions, which were, you know, a very powerful tool to teach people history and just for entertainment. So, you know, these earliest ballads have Robin Hood stories happening in Barnsdale Forest, which is south of Yorkshire and not in Sherwood Forest. So apparently the forest has a real story behind it, which I thought was my favorite part of this whole research that I did. So because of the Norman conquest of England in 1066, common folk were no longer allowed to hunt or cut trees down. Two things that were very important, you think, because you can get energy from trees, you can get building supplies from trees, and you can, of course, hunt the animals for food in the woods. So this hunting area, these acres, were actually very important hunting grounds for the locals. They got a lot of their food from there. So the woods actually remained intact because of the protection put on by the law. And this area lent itself very nicely to the story of Robin Hood because it was, you know, one of the surviving areas where it was still a dark, mysterious forest. So by the 15th century, we're starting to see this version of Robin Hood emerge that resembles kind of like the modern day version that we have today. Robin Hood and his crew were still not these spotless knight in shining armor type guys like they are today. For example, in the 15th century, some of Robin Hood's men actually killed a monk who was corrupt, no doubt, but they killed his servant who was a complete innocent. Just to keep it quiet, because those two people knew who Robin Hood actually was.
Yeah, so the story basically evolves with the morals of the culture, of the times.
Right, exactly.
Yeah, because it is, again, like asking the question almost, like, was Robin Hood real? There's no yes or no answer to that. There's an evolving mythology that is playing off, you know, real events and maybe some real people who are in turn playing off the mythology.
Yeah, I imagine it gets contaminated over time as well, yeah, with each telling, and new things crop up and seep in, yeah, and you'll never get back to the original.
They were writing ballads, Evan, right? So you have people writing different stories, or they're like books, you know, amongst themselves. Like, you know, hey, I'm writing this cool ballad about Robin Hood, and what's he up to this time? So one thing, there's a couple of things that happened during the 15th century leading into the 16th century. We see themes like stealing from the rich and giving to the poor, a fighter of the lower, you know, fighting for the lower class and fighting against the upper class, the privileged upper class, right? So of course that appealed to everybody back then because the everybody was lower class. But then in the 16th century, very strangely, Robin Hood began to appeal to upper class people as well. And he became, he shed some of his more dangerous traits and he became a nobleman kind of. He became someone that everybody could respect. So some of the upper class looked at him. And this is what we get in the movies, right? Some of the upper class were rooting for him because certain people in the upper class become the evil people, not all the upper class.
Yeah, it's interesting. And you could substitute a lot of quasi mythological, you know, historical figures for Robin Hood, like Jesus, right? It's this exact same thing. No, seriously, yeah, like there's a mythology that evolves out of the mythology in that time and place with common themes and elements. And maybe there were tendrils of other stories woven in. Some may have related to specific people, but the Jesus Christ of the New Testament, that codified story, that did not exist any more than the modern version of Robin Hood existed. And being able to draw some connection to a person who was involved somehow in one of the tendrils that got woven into the mythology doesn't mean that that guy was Robin Hood, right? Mm-hmm.
Oh, absolutely.
Or no. That Robin Hood as we know it
existed. Yeah.
No,
that he's not mythological. Yeah.
What you have in the end, what we know today, what we're presented with through Hollywood and our books and everything else, it's an amalgamation of all those things.
Yeah, but at some point it gets codified, right? Somebody writes a story that becomes the Robin Hood story, just like somebody wrote the New Testament and that became the – although, in fact, there were many, many different versions. And then at some point, Constantine, I believe, you know, decided these four are canon and the rest are heresy. Mm. But the rest were just as legitimate, you know, as the four that ended up, you know, being official.
You know what else I thought was really cool? So at one point, I read that Shakespeare wrote about Robin Hood. Mm-hmm. But then we're not 100% sure that Shakespeare existed, or, you know, it's a very complicated thing to unravel. Did Shakespeare exist, or what plays did, you know, who wrote what, and, you know, and all that. It just blew my mind that you could have like the question upon question folded into each other like that.
But to be clear, Shakespeare was a dude. Like, we have a lot of documentation around Shakespeare. There's just questions about certain plays.
Yeah, yeah, I mean, I wanted to clarify that.
We have like portraits of him, and we know who he was married to, and like there's a lot of info on Shakespeare.
There's a minority of scholars who question Shakespeare's authorship on some of the plays, but the consensus I think is pretty solid that, you know, obviously William Shakespeare existed. There definitely was a guy, William Shakespeare, who was a playwright, and, you know, I think the consensus is that he's the author of the works attributed to William Shakespeare.
So what are you saying, Steve? Like, you know, I shouldn't believe in the minority opinion, even if those people happen to be, you know, professionals and maybe even respected. Like, is there a 97% consensus here that, yeah, that Shakespeare existed? And who the hell am I to question those 97% globally, these people that are all over the world? Don't get me started, okay? Yeah.
I mean, this is an entirely separate tangent we're going off on here, but like there have been analyses of Shakespeare's many works. He is the most studied author in history, and it's all of the evidence points to a single author with his background, education, time and place, everything. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
It's a pretty solid case.
Yeah, you can't talk about
Shakespeare
Robin Hood
authorship. But it's the bigger issue of how do we know? How do we know these historical figures existed? And like when you start to delve into this, people point out, it's like, yeah, we're not even really sure that
Jesus existed.
Well, no, there are other, you know, who was I thinking of? Like there are other people like William the Conqueror. Did he exist? It's like, well, if you really delve down to the original source material, it's pretty thinly sourced. These ancient historical, what we think of as historical figures, as opposed to literary figures or mythological figures. There's the farther back in time you go, the more those things all get muddied together.
Sure.
And media doesn't help usually. Like, remember when we were in Scotland and we learned all about Braveheart and what we thought we knew about Braveheart versus what historians know about Braveheart. It was a totally different guy. Right?
Yeah.
Like,
oh, we knew because, though. Yeah. Wrong.
Yeah. Movie, but sometimes, you know, these stories are told and they become the public consciousness. They become codified. Yeah. Like you were talking about codification. It can become recodified every time something new happens where, you know, a whole new generation is not going to read certain works and they're only going to think of what they know based on a film or based on a play or based on a song.
That's scary.
And they get reinterpreted based upon the new culture, new ideas.
Zeitgeist.
Yeah.
So, all right. So here's the next news item I'm going to talk about. It also has a lot to do with perspective and narrative. Have you guys ever heard or had this figure quoted to you that medical errors are the third leading cause of death?
Yes.
Yeah. Absolutely seen. Yeah. Like memes or headlines with that.
Yeah. That's quacks and cranks and alternative medicine proponents have just been salivating over this ever since these figures were first published. You hear things like 250 to 400,000 thrown around, and then that number creeps up over time. I've heard as high as 715,000 per year deaths due to medical errors.
In the United States, right?
In the United States, yeah.
Oh, man.
Which now, makes it like
these are all caused by you, though, right, Steve?
Makes it the third leading cause of death of all causes of death. So just let me cut to the chase a little bit. That's total bullshit. But let's delve a little bit into the numbers. And David Gorski wrote about this on Science Based Medicine earlier in the week. So if you want to like go into the nitty gritty details, I suggest you read that article. But I'm going to give you, we're just going to talk about it to give some perspective on how these numbers can be so ridiculous and what the real numbers probably are. But first of all, it's one of those things where, again, before you answer the question, you have to understand what question you're asking. And you have to understand what it means for a medical error to, quote unquote, be the cause of death. You have to define what a medical error is. Let me give you an example of how tricky this can get. So let's say that there's a disease. Untreated, this disease will kill 50 out of 100 people, right?
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Okay.
And if I get, there's a treatment for the disease, the treatment will save those 50 people, but side effects from the treatment will kill one person.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So we give that treatment to everybody with the disease, right. And then instead of 50 people dying, one person dies. But then I could legitimately say that medical treatment is the cause of all deaths.
For that disease. Yeah,
right.
You could.
Well, in that population. You know, let's say I had a magical treatment that cured all disease but killed 1% of the people who took the treatment. Then that treatment would be the 100% cause of all death.
That's true.
Yeah,
so what's the point?
The point is that if you only look at the risk and you don't look at the benefit statistically, then you don't really have a good idea about what the net effect of the treatment is. So what you really want to know is what are the excess deaths due to medical misadventure, right? Due to medical errors or medical treatment. You don't want to just know, like, when did anything go wrong that led to somebody's death without counting, but how many people would have died if you didn't get that treatment? How many people also
whole point.
Yeah, or let's look, take another hypothetical situation where you have a disease that is terminal, you know, 100% of the people are going to die with that disease and the treatment will save 10% of them, but, you know, there's a 1% complication rate. And, you know, in the people with the complication, a lot of them die. Well, yeah, it's because there are a lot of them going to die anyway. You know what
I
mean?
Yeah, but tell me if I'm wrong, Steve. Going back to your original example where there's 100 people, 50 of them would heal on their own. The other 50 would need medical intervention to save their lives. 1%, or I'm sorry, one out of those 50 has the complication. But generally speaking, all of the people or a larger percentage of the people are going to seek treatment than those that would die on their own, which means that we might be inducing death in one person who would have lived on their own. And so that's, I think, the question at hand, right?
Well, that's the concern. You know, that's why you need to know the total numbers. Is it the situation? I'm just giving you hypothetical situations where just answering the question, how many people who died had a complication of a medical intervention, doesn't tell you much. Because you need to know how many of them are going to die anyway and how many people were saved by those interventions. And unless you put it statistically in the context of those components, you get a completely distorted view. So, but that's just one issue that is not addressed by these studies. But let's look at the other more direct questions. How are you counting people died by medical error? So,
yeah, is that 750,000 number actually accurate?
So the 750,000 number is made up by quacks. Forget
okay.
that. The number that was actually published was about 100,000 per year.
Yeah, that's a very small number.
No, 100,000 is still a massive number. That's an overestimate by about 20-fold.
Really?
Wow.
Yeah. So, but this is how they got to that number. They looked at hospital records. They looked at databases that would include information from hospital treatment. And they basically, anyone who died who had an adverse medical event, they counted as death by the adverse event. But they didn't really know what the cause of death was. Does that make sense?
And they didn't also account for the fact that they might have had things that would have killed them anyway.
Yes, right.
Yeah, that's important.
And they didn't really separate out known complications. Like, in other words, not every adverse event is a medical error. Some adverse events, like, you know you're going to get it. It's, you're taking that as a given.
You have your surgery, the doctor tells you there's a chance.
Yeah.
Your surgery will cause this to happen. Are you willing to take that risk?
Yeah, exactly. Or it's like you're going to get a scar. That's like that's a side effect. It's not a adverse event. You know, it's just that that's part and parcel of getting the procedure done. There are certain things that happen. So what we really want to know is what is termed in the literature as a medical misadventure, where an actual mistake becomes the proximate cause of death. You know, leads to that person's death. They would not have otherwise died. And it wasn't just a trade-off of getting the treatment. And if and so there's a new study which actually does separate out the data a lot better in terms of separating out medical misadventures from known complications, from minor adverse events, et cetera. And the numbers that they come up with are down in the like 2,000 to 3,000. Wow. So not 100,000, not 200,000, not these mythical figures, 400,000. It's like 2,000 to 3,000. The other thing is that any physician looking at the number even a little bit deeply would have known that it was total nonsense. Because if you do the calculations, and again, David Gorski goes over this very well in his study, then like almost everyone who dies in the hospital is dying from a complication in order for those numbers to be correct, which is ridiculous. You know how many patients I am personally aware of who died from a medical mistake? Maybe in my 20, 30-year career, I know of one or two.
Well, that's it?
That's it.
Clearly, like, you're covering up.
No, I mean, seriously, who I could say, yeah, that guy died because this physician didn't do what they were supposed to do or whatever. Not just like it was a known complication. I know more patients who died because they rolled the dice and the dice didn't roll their way, right? That happens. But from like an actual like oops kind of mistake, it's single digits, you know?
So those people have recourse.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. I mean, there's a system in place for people. I mean, not that it brings them back, which is, you know, it's a horrible thing to have happen, but it's not like they're out on their asses either, or their family members aren't. You know, there's a system in place.
Malpractice insurance.
I've reviewed many malpractice cases, and the vast majority of them that I've reviewed were not caused by substandard care, which is substandard care is basically the legal threshold. It's just that's what happens. You know what I mean?
Where people probably get benefits for not medical mistakes, but just negative outcomes than actually medical
but
mistakes.
There's just like negative outcomes from appropriate medical care, but it's just the dice didn't roll their way. And then there definitely were cases where somebody made a mistake. And those are the ones that lead all the way to either a settlement or a trial. But that's a vast minority of cases. It's very tiny. So I'm not trying to say that mistakes aren't made. I mean, mistakes are made all the time. Most of them are minor. They're picked up. You know, we have the Swiss cheese model in medicine, which means that everyone takes responsibility for everything that comes their way. You know what I mean? So that hopefully if one person drops the ball, somebody else will pick it up. And also the other thing I will say, in every case that I've reviewed where I thought, yep, this was malpractice, this was bad, at least three people screwed up. Like that's kind of the theme.
Check
like,
the balance is failed.
Yeah, like the bad thing doesn't happen unless multiple people all failed in the same way, which of course is very, very unlikely. The other thing the data shows is that the death due to genuine medical error, that's been falling. It's fallen by about 21% in the last 36 years because the tools are better. Yeah, the tools are better. And then also
systems are better.
The systems are better. We have committees. Hospitals have committees, and all they do is try to figure out, hey, what went wrong? How do we keep that from going wrong again? You know,
you have those mortality. What are they called?
M&M, morbidity and mortality. There are postmortems, but there's also M&M conference, morbidity and mortality, where it's like, okay, it's basically what went wrong. But there's also something called quality control. There are quality control committees in medical care that develop systems, like the Swiss cheese. I didn't make that up. That's what we learned. This is how you keep miscommunications, you know, avoid miscommunications. This is how you avoid errors. This is right. Yes, of course, it still happens because it's a massively complicated endeavor that we're doing here.
Right. And you're servicing more people now than ever, probably.
Well,
but the idea that the very idea, though, that it was like the third leading cause of death was always a fiction. But it was a fiction that was greedily welcomed by the quacks and now has taken on a life of its own.
And it still will after today.
And lapped up by the public, who largely have a great misunderstanding of statistics.
Yeah.
And you can't overlook that. And
fear of medicine.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the other thing, right? Like, I don't understand statistics and I'm deathly afraid of going to the doctor. Obviously, it's not because of the doctor. It's because of the reason I'm having to go to the doctor. Yeah. But those things get conflated in people's minds all the time. I mean, you know, hospitals mean death to a lot of people. Mm-hmm. And so it's very easy for them to make that leap.
Yeah.
I'm interested, Steve, did they ever talk about these situations in which there are this is such a hard thing to quantify even. How do you quantify a diagnostic, maybe not error, but an inability to diagnose? Like, you know, when somebody dies because something wasn't caught, which, like, how do you catch something that you don't know you're trying to catch?
So that, again, it's the same thing where...
Standard of care?
It's a standard of care. Okay. Should that diagnosis have been made by a competent physician practicing within the standard of care? Or is it just that was a really bizarre case and even a competent physician doing performing reasonably may have missed it? But then did they react appropriately when the patient didn't get better? Like, there's often, again, like there's multiple layers where, like, did they refer to a specialist? Did they, you know, reevaluate the patient? Did they do what they were supposed to do? Or did they just preside over a case that they didn't diagnose properly and didn't understand? You know, and again, there are also cases that I've seen where, in retrospect, a genius might have figured it out, but a very competent physician may have missed it because it was just a really unusual case. So you don't have to be perfect in order to avoid malpractice, right? You just, malpractice means like you were practicing below the standard of care. You weren't perfect with godlike prescience and know everything. No, that's not a reasonable standard and nobody expects that. So that's different as well. But you can see it's all gray. A lot of it is gray. Sometimes, I've been involved with cases where, the few cases that I know of, that was just an error. You did this wrong. You made this mistake and that led to this patient's death. But there are lots of other cases where it's like, oh, we might have caught this a little bit earlier. You know what I mean? Like if our algorithm were tweaked a little bit, if it was a little bit, you know, if it were optimized.
Or if we had a trauma center in this, you know, rural area.
Or whatever. Yeah. You make judgment calls based upon risk versus benefit all the time. And you could Monday morning quarterback any time things don't go well. With hindsight, you know, you could always say, oh, this would have been a slightly more efficient pathway to get to where we needed to go. But, you know, medicine's hard. Medicine is hard. But the idea of saying like people dying from errors, you know, that is, again, there's you could define that in multiple ways, but by the most reasonable, I think, definition, the specific number they came up with was 5,200 deaths a year caused by an adverse medical event, with, you know, a larger number where it's a contributing factor, but it wasn't the cause. The person didn't die from that. So that's still way too high. I mean, we want to get that number down, but 5,000 is a lot less than 400,000, you know?
Oh my gosh.
And I'm sure you see big variation in terms of different physicians and different centers and one bad doctor.
That's extensively studied as well. And so like there's lots of data looking at, for example, outcomes for patients with a stroke who are admitted to a general service, a neurology service, and a stroke service, and the outcomes are better. The more expertise you have, the better the outcomes. But we just don't have the resources to have every patient with a stroke admitted to an academic stroke center. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. It would be great if we did. We know the outcomes are better because the expertise level is higher. But how do you account for that? You know, that's really fuzzy to try to quantify that.
Yeah, how do you account for
that?
these SES differences? And, you know, these are big institutional problems, or I shouldn't say institutional, societal problems. They're bigger than medicine.
And that's it's also like how much money are we willing to spend, right? There's also a cost effectiveness equation here. You know, we could practice medicine in such a way that if we just – if cost were no object, absolutely we could drive down negative outcomes further. But we can't afford that.
Yeah.
By orders of magnitude, you know, we have to practice efficient medicine as well. That's just the reality. But I think the bottom line is, if you look, you still want to look at the end of the day, the most important number is risk versus benefit. How many people are saved versus how many people are harmed? And you have to look at overall outcomes, you know, to see that. But there's a reason, you know, why we're living twice as long now as we were 100 years ago. It's because in the aggregate, the treatments are effective. Their benefits vastly outweigh the risks. But there's no way the risks are going to be zero. There's no way you're going to do everything we need to do and not have any negative consequences along the way. Mm-hmm. Right. And again, the other thing is the more heroic you get, the more aggressive you get, the greater the complication rate's going to be. Mm-hmm. Right. And but you don't want physicians and surgeons, you know, to be gun shy, because that happens. If you start to track those numbers in too simplistic a way, right? Like you start publishing, like, you know, how many people did this died on the surgeon's table in isolation? Then surgeons start selecting the better cases to give to make their numbers look good. They're yeah. like, I don't want to operate on you because you're probably going to
die.
Right. And that's going to make my numbers look bad. But it's not taking a risk versus benefit assessment for that patient. It's just saying we want to minimize negative outcomes. I want to minimize being the proximal cause of death.
We see it in academia too, or I shouldn't say academia, in public school too, and or private institutions where it's like, oh, we want better outcomes, so we're only going to select kids from a certain background, or you know, kids that have a certain level of whatever academic success. And look, we're a blue ribbon school all of a sudden, which is like just horrible.
Exactly. Right. That's why you want to look more at like, okay, what's your surgical complication rate normalized to the severity of the patients you're treating? Right. Just like you say, if you're going to judge teachers based upon how much did they improve their students, not where their students are. So, right. Not the net outcome, but the net improvement. What was the value added to their students? So it's the same thing. It's like, yeah, if you're willing to take really risky cases, your numbers superficially will look bad. But even if you're the best surgeon in the world, but maybe that's the surgeon we want operating on the most difficult cases, but just don't hold them then responsible for the predictable outcomes of taking on risky cases. And that's the same is true of medicine in general. You know, 50 years ago, there were cases where they would say, there's nothing more we could do. We're just going to make them comfortable and then say your goodbyes. And now where they're in the ICU, they're getting all kinds of aggressive care. They still may die, but then you could say, well, they died getting all of these aggressive interventions. So yeah, they were going to die anyway, but if you want any chance that they're going to live, then this is what we need to do.
And now we're finally starting to see, it's funny, it's gone almost too far in one direction in certain areas, and we're starting to see a new movement of like how much intervention is too much intervention. And now we're talking back about quality versus that kind of aggressive care, and it's finding that balance, right? Because when we go, oh my gosh, some people are living, now we're looking at the risk-benefit again of the comfort level.
Yeah, or also futile care.
You know? And waste of
resources. Yeah.
Families expect the pull out all the stops care, even when it's not appropriate.
And even sometimes when the patient is like, "Yeah, no more."
right.
Yeah, that's the important point.
Complicated question, very complicated question. But you know, we do need to have some reasonable perspective on what's happening. And that number, I always get frustrated when people throw that number in my face and they have no idea what's behind it.
And then you're like, can we have a 40-minute conversation?
I know. It's like it would take a long time to unravel it.
But listen to this episode of the Skeptics.
It serves its rhetorical purpose, you know, never mind the actual facts. Well, everyone, we're going to take a quick break from our show to talk about our sponsor this week, The Great Courses Plus.
Steve, The Great Courses Plus, huh?
Yeah.
That's what I'm talking about. you know what I did? I went to the Great Courses Plus website again just to see what they got. I love, you know, looking through, what is it, 10,000 different courses they have on there. Here's a quick list of them. Tai Chi, How to Draw, Everyday Engineering, Understanding Investments, The Science of Information. And you know what? You know what I'm going to say? The list just keeps going on for like 10,000 more times.
This week, guys, we're asking you to check out their new course, Introduction to Astrophysics, by Dr. Joshua Wynn. He presents intriguing questions about how the universe works and the logic of how to answer these questions using physical principles, of course. There's a lot of great little chapters in here. I particularly liked the properties of stars. Tidal forces was fascinating. Zooming into particles, dark matter, of course, lots of stuff here, lots of chapters. There's about 24 of them. So there's lots
it's
of
exactly 24 of them.
Yes, exactly. Mundo. There's lots of chapters and great primer. I recommend it. So check it out.
And guys, you can sample The Great Courses Plus for free with unlimited access to learn just about everything. Start your free trial now by going to thegreatcoursesplus.com/skeptics. That's thegreatcoursesplus.com/skeptics.
All right, guys, let's get back to the show. All right, let's move on to the next one. Kara, you're going to tell us about the wandering magnetic North Pole.
Basically, as we know, deep, deep, deep inside of the Earth, there is a core. There's an inner core, which is solid. There's an outer core, which is liquid. And there are the materials that make up this core, mainly iron, but there's a lot of other materials, are electrically charged materials. And so based on the way that the planet spins, based on a lot of other factors, there's hypothesized to be a lot of dynamism, if you want to put it that way, a lot of change within that liquid outer core. And that change is actually what's affecting the magnetic field of the Earth, right? So we've got this magnetosphere. Bob talks about it all the time. And the magnetosphere has a very particular – you've seen the drawings with the field lines. Think of Earth as being basically a dipole. So it's almost as if Earth had a bar magnet in the middle of it. It doesn't. But the way that this this liquid outer core acts almost gives us this bar magnet effect. But the interesting thing is that the magnetic pole does not line up with the geographic pole.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So that gets confusing. Yep. Yes. It gets a little bit confusing when it comes to navigation. And actually, I learned that there's three. Yeah, exactly. There's magnetic north. That's what your compass can find. Right. That's the point where the field lines point vertically down. There's geomagnetic north, and that's the place where the actual full kind of pattern points to north. And that actually hasn't changed all that much. Geographical north or physical north. And so those three things are not always or ever really in alignment. And what we're talking about is magnetic north, the place where your compass actually points. And the problem for navigation is that if your compass is pointing magnetic north, but you're trying to get to geographic north, you're going to be wandering a little bit.
And for the animals who rely on magnetic north, I imagine that also
it might
their ability to navigate and other things.
It could. The interesting thing is, first of all, it doesn't seem to affect anything above like a pretty high up latitude, like 55 or something like that. And we're talking miles. You know, at this point, hundreds of miles. Like, it's actually been moving quite a bit. And we'll talk about that. We'll talk about exactly where and how in a second. But animals aren't usually trying to get to an exact address, so they're probably okay. whereas people, you know, if you're trying to actually navigate up near the North Pole, you might actually end up like really far from the point where you're supposed to be. So there is something called the World Magnetic Model.
Cool.
It started in 1831. The first magnetic north was actually located in Canada. Since then, the pole has been moving northerly for the most part. There was like a weird little back drag, but it has been moving northerly for the most part. And over decades and decades and decades, we're talking hundreds of miles. I think the average right now is about 34 miles a year, but that's new. Only in the 90s did we start to see this. Before, it was like 15.
Three digit.
It was even it was pretty low prior to that. And then it made this big jump.
That's scary.
Remember, It seems scary, but we're also talking about from 1831 is when we started measuring this. There's a good chance that this has happened, you know, very often, that it's happened in much larger. Like, we're like, oh, it's very active right now compared to what, right? Compared to our experience. We know that the poles have actually flipped, and it could be pretty dramatic, but we've only been measuring it since 1831. So we found it in 1831. After that, we did a big mission, the last one in 2015. And there's this update that happens now. It's between NOAA, that's the U.S. National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, and the British Geological Survey. But here's an interesting hurdle, interesting hiccup. The new model it updates every 5 years. We weren't supposed to update until 2020, but we're moving too fast. And apparently we got to the point where it was untenable for GPS. Like, it was getting to the point where it was too bad that GPS wouldn't be able to be as accurate as we would need it to be. So they wanted to move that date up. And then the government shut down. We were all set to do this new update and the government shut down. And so the British Geological Survey was like ready, and they actually published. But because NOAA houses the update, we had to wait until the government came back. So it was just this Monday that we had the newest update. So we should have much more accurate navigation at this point. A couple quals. I know this isn't a what do you know, but this is something that I learned in doing this. The North Pole has been super wandery for a long time. South Pole, not so much.
Yeah, yeah.
Nobody really knows why either.
I was just going to say why, but so,
yeah, doesn't you would think that South would move in accordance with North. It would kind of mirror each other.
Yeah, but Kara, do you think it's because there's just more gravity down there?
Because it's in the southern part of the planet,
well,
down at the bottom?
One of these researchers who's been interviewed a lot in talking about this new update, he has a particular hypothesis about patches of more magnetism in the north. So there's like this patch that's sort of under Siberia and this patch that's sort of under Canada. And historically, the Siberian one had more pull, and now the Canadian one is pulling more, and it may actually be causing this wander that's lopsided, right? That we don't have that same kind of push-pull in the South Pole. He also has talked about these jets within the outer core where the liquid may be moving more quickly for whatever reason they're still trying to figure out, and that could have a real outcome on the speed of the magnetic wandering. So, you know, there's a lot of hypotheses. There's, you know, some evidence to support them, but right now there's not a lot. So they're trying to figure that out. But like I said, they've only started really modeling these things computationally within like 5 to 10 years, like really trying to understand the Coriolis effect and how it affects these columnar wiggles within the outer core of the Earth and what that does for these massive magnetic field lines. All this stuff is only just starting to come together with the ability to measure it using satellites and, you know, technology that we just didn't have a long time ago. So it's pretty cool. It's a pretty hot area of science. We're learning a lot about it. We're learning a lot about what's happening to North and how it's going to keep happening. I think there's no doubt that North is going to continue to shift, but whether it's going to start shifting even faster or whether it's going to slow down, we literally have no idea, because the only evidence we have as to the fact that these polar reversals have occurred in the past is based on rocks.
Frozen,
it's literally
yeah.
based on, yeah, the way that the magnetic minerals, I guess you can say, within the rocks look. And so we think this takes geologic timescales, like 1,000 years for the poles to flip. We don't think it's going to happen overnight, so we don't think it's going to negatively affect us in a way that we can't mitigate. But things could get weird for a while. Like,
very
if we didn't
weird.
Have these updates, our compasses could be pointing to the equator or something. Like, they could, it'd be super strange. So it's a cool thing to keep our eye on, and it's something that, I don't know, I guess probably not a lot of people know. Like, we've heard about it, but maybe, oh, and Killer's really excited about it too, as you can hear.
Clearly.
Kara, let me ask you a question.
Yeah.
What's the equator?
I know. That's what the equator is called in Texas.
Oh, the equator.
Yeah.
Equator.
That's my equator, my
there
insurance.
The equator.
Yeah, equator, insurance, and umbrella. Thank you, Texas fans. You know what I'm talking about. It's just how we pronounce things in the South.
All right. Love it. Gotcha. I love it.
All right, Evan, so why is everyone drinking celery juice now?
Apparently everyone is drinking celery juice, because if you're on Instagram, I guess you can't get away from the fact that everybody is drinking celery juice. But this is an Instagram craze, apparently, for as much as a craze can be quantified, concerning celery juice. Celery juice has, apparently quite recently, in the last few months, become the latest and greatest healthy beverage food of choice. And I suppose it shouldn't come as a great surprise, because what you have is this combination of these famous models and famous people, Miranda Kerr, Kim Kardashian, and others who are claiming that they're drinking it every morning for various reasons. And then there's also the famous actresses' websites, you know, like Gwyneth Paltrow's Goop, of course, calling the juice a miracle potion.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and you have other sites calling it one of the greatest healing tonics of all time. So when you have these combinations of celebrity power and snake oil purveyors, it should come as little surprise that you get 67,000 hashtags about celery juice on Instagram.
And some of it, it's funny, when you search for celery juice, some of the hashtags are just on like people's regular posts, because they know people are looking at hashtag celery juice. So they're not even about celery juice. They're just like, oh, look at my dog, hashtag celery juice.
They're cheating. That's totally cheating.
So, Evan, I drink green juice almost every day.
Do you?
I actually don't put celery in my green juice because I think it's gross.
Oh, I love celery. Do,
yeah, lots of people like the taste of it. I don't. I have a thing about celery. It grosses me out. So, you know, apple, kale, spinach, cucumber, that's usually my core with Greek yogurt. Mm-hmm. I drink that literally every day.
Yep.
Why am I going to die young, but the people who drink celery juice are going to live forever?
Oh, wow. Because you don't know, Kara, that celery juice has all sorts of benefits to it based on what these people are telling us. For example, here are some of the miraculous benefits that are being touted on the internet. Celery juice flushes viruses out of the body. Celery juice helps with migraines. Celery juice increases bile, which apparently is a good thing for some people, maybe. I don't know. Celery juice restores the central nervous system. Right, Steve? Neurology?
What does that mean?
Yes, exactly. Celery juice helps clear psoriasis. Celery juice enhances gut bacteria. It keeps Crohn's disease symptoms at bay, helps those with mental illnesses, and yes, it can help with your sex life. And that's just a sample, a small sample of the claims being touted out there about celery juice.
In reality, it does nothing.
It does.
Well, I mean, it does what eating celery does.
Right.
It's a vegetable. It's, you should eat your vegetables,
vitamins
and it's
it,
fine.
Right?
But that's it. There is no superfood. You know, there's no one miracle food. It's just nonsense. I used to, even when I was younger, I loved celery. Actually, I used to eat celery with peanut butter.
Yes.
Really, yeah, people love that.
Absolutely.
Did you do it with the raisins? Wow. You call it ants on a log?
Oh, I've heard that.
No. Peanut butter.
I was never a raisins fan, but kids at school used to eat that as well. And I do love peanut butter and celery. It's great. It actually is.
Or
great.
Just with like Italian salad dressing, just dunk the celery.
Oh, yeah, just like a salad, mini.
Yeah, basically.
Now,
I would do that with some balsamic vinegar, you know, that some cucumbers.
By juicing your celery, you're actually taking away one of the healthy components of it. You're taking the fiber out. Because the stalk itself has fiber, and we all want some fiber in our diet. So you're actually...
Well, if you're using a juicer.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and sometimes they specifically say to take the pulp out, but the pulp is the fiber. That's actually...
Yeah.
If you're going to eat celery, fiber. That's half the benefit is going to be from the pulp.
I use a Vitamix, so I just blend all my vegetables, so I still have everything in it.
I just
you know, I don't
salad.
Juice it and do the pulp.
Well, that's just it.
You know what? I don't like kale, but when you mix it in with a bunch of other stuff, you can drink it, and it's really easy.
Yeah, the more things you put into a green salad, I think, is better, even if it's things you wouldn't otherwise maybe eat on their own or as a side dish.
I love putting chopped celery in salads because they're little crunchy bits, and it's great for the texture.
I love it.
And it doesn't really taste like much. It tastes like whatever the dressing is that you're eating with it.
That's right.
Yeah.
It's 95% water. I mean,
I don't like it.
So
Steve.
The article that I read the other day that sort of put me down the rabbit hole of celery and celery juice, it was a very short article, nothing really in depth. It was only really throwing it out there for the recognizing of this current fad. And but you get into it a little more and you start looking up some articles, and obviously you're going to come across the stuff that it say it has miraculous healing powers. But you're also going to, at least for the aggregates that I'm using and the search engines that I'm using, you're going to come across a lot of articles that say, is there really any kind of great benefit or miracle health going on here? And a lot of them are consulting, thank goodness, scientists and dietitians and people who are medical experts. And they're coming back and saying no, because there's been very few scientific studies about celery and its benefits towards specific ailments.
So I looked, I did a PubMed search on celery juice. It had like a couple of hundred articles. They were all, you know, preclinical. I didn't see a single clinical study looking at it.
Right.
Huh.
And did you see
ones like on rats?
Rats.
Yeah, those
gerbils.
Are rat studies.
Yep.
Yeah.
Gerbil study as well. Oh, but there is one human pilot study published in the Natural Medicine Journal 2013. 30 patients participated. They had mild to moderate hypertension, and they took daily extracts of celery, not the juice, just a supplement. And after 6 weeks, they reported some benefits. Now, unfortunately, though, there was no control group, and the chief authors of the study were managing partners at a company that made the extract. So, so that's what you get.
And also, there's no way to know if they just didn't eat vegetables before.
Right.
As I said, there were no peer-reviewed articles looking at celery.
Yeah.
What happens is somebody will try to corner the market on some kind of product, and then they try to get it to be the latest fad superfood once they already have secured their supply chain.
Mm. Right? Sure. Wow, that's a great idea. Mm.
or that they're trying to sell a book. They have to have the super miracle cure in their book or their website or whatever. It's all just marketing. It's just that, and it's always going to be something new. It's like fashion. You have to have something new, and it's all planned. You know what I mean? There's no real reason to suspect that celery juice or whatever the latest superfood fad is, it has any of these properties. It's all just a marketing scam, basically. The most obvious example of this was the green coffee beans. Remember when that was the fad, superfood?
Yeah. Oh, boy.
Where that's, you know, literally what happened. The guy sort of cornered the market on the supply chain and then tried to go on Dr. Oz to make it seem like this is the latest, greatest superfood. It's all bullshit. So bottom line, eat your vegetables and don't miss out on the fiber. But there is no superfood. You need to have an overall healthful diet. That's it.
There you go.
And celery is good. All right, here we go. Next one, Bob. So you're going to give us a CRISPR update. And in response to this, I've been reading a lot about CRISPR, and it's just getting more and more amazing.
Yeah. This is something I saw. I was like, let's really cover this time. So CRISPR has been in the news lately. Specifically, new variations like CRISPR-Cas14 and CRISPR-Cas X, or is it 10?
It's
not
X.
Not quite sure.
It's X.
Yeah, pretty sure it's X.
Because I thought that too. Is that X for 10? No, but is X as opposed to Y?
Right. So, yeah, I thought they might have been following the iPhone naming convention. But are Cas9's days numbered? And by the way, how the hell does CRISPR-Cas whatever even work?
Right.
How's it work, Bob?
So, we've talked about CRISPR before, and of course, we all love it. We see it has huge potential to cure diseases, improve foods, and basically turn us all into superheroes. So, we pretty much buy all that.
Off the top of your head, without looking, can you tell me what CRISPR stands for?
Yes, of course. Clustered regularly interspaced short palindromic repeats.
Very good.
Yeah.
If I didn't know that after doing 3 days of research on this, Bob, me to the curb.
Yo. What does laser stand for?
Light amplification by stimulating emission of radiation. Stop testing me, Jay.
What does goop stand for?
Nobody knows.
As I said, CRISPR is an acronym for clustered regularly interspaced short palindromic repeats. And it sounds super complicated, right? Well, guess what? It really is damn complicated. This is going to be a kindergarten level of understanding. But hopefully you'll enjoy it and learn a little bit. So let's look at this. So what do those words even mean? So if we look at the last part of it, the short palindromic repeats, we've heard of palindromes, right? Those are just like a sequence of words or letters that are just repeated backward the same way. So this is kind of what we're talking about. These are repeated short runs of DNA, just like 20 to 40 letters in a bacterial genome. And so not all of them are palindromes, but most of the time they're palindromic. So imagine that in your head. You've got these repeats, one next to the other, but there's a space between each one of these repeating sections. And that's the other part of CRISPR, the CRI, the clustered regularly interspaced section. So that means that between these palindromic repeats, there's a space, and it's called spacer DNA. And these are unique areas of DNA. And we didn't even know what the hell they were. Throughout the 80s and 90s, we're like, what is this stuff? Finally, into the 2000s, they found out that what this was the DNA comes from previous infections that the bacteria experienced. Now, typically, they would get infected, but they get infected by viruses, especially bacteriophages. So now spacer DNA then is basically mugshots of punk DNA, right? It's the most wanted list in the post office that says, shoot this DNA on site, no questions asked. Mm. So that's CRISPR. That's basically CRISPR. It's got this code separated by these little snippets of DNA from previous infections. So on the other side of the coin there are the genes that are associated with CRISPR. Now, you've heard of CRISPR-Cas9. Mm-hmm. Cas, C-A-S, simply means CRISPR-associated. That's all it means, CRISPR-associated 9, basically for Cas9, the one that's most common. So these genes make special enzymes called nucleases that are essentially hunter-killer scissors for DNA, right? They seek out specific DNA and they do something, like they cut it, for example. So we've got these two primary components. We've got the CRISPR, which is basically the mugshot DNA, essentially a history of previous infections. And then we've got the Cas, the CRISPR-associated genes, which create proteins to do the dirty work, right? Finding and snipping the DNA or adding new DNA, insertions or whatever. So those are the two main components.
To be clear, though, it's the CRISPR that does the finding, right? Though the CRISPR will seek out a segment of DNA that is specific to the virus, right? That it quote unquote remembers, and then it attaches to the Cas protein, which then does the cleaving, which then will cut it. So the CRISPR,
right? So I said that the Cas is not the hunter.
The Cas is just the cleaver. CRISPR is the hunter. The Cas is the cleaver.
Right. So the CRISPR has the mugshots of the previous infections and how to get there.
It seeks it out and attaches to it and delivers the payload. The Cas is the payload. And so what it basically does is it hunts out the virus and then it cuts it to ribbons with the Cas proteins.
So what we're talking about here is it's an adaptive immune system for many types of bacteria. So this discovery, clearly, when this was realized over 10, 15 years ago in the aughts, the discovery clearly had the potential to be this powerful new tool for humanity, and we've run with it. We have totally taken this and run with it. And what we've done is we've adapted it to more generic and more into a more generic, more powerful genome editing tool for use in plants, animals, and of course humans as well. Now, in the process, we found these amazingly useful Cas genes. Other ones, Cas9, of course, is the most popular one. That's very versatile and very helpful for potential therapies. So Cas9, though, originally was kind of not nearly as impressive as it is now. It essentially just snipped DNA, and that was all that it did. Now, what we've turned it into over the years, though, is this multifunctional tool that can snip and insert and do all sorts of interesting things. But Cas9 isn't the only game in town here. We're talking, there's a Cas12, there's a Cas13, and they cut DNA as well, but they're a little bit more indiscriminate than Cas9. And this makes them a little bit less ideal for therapies, but what they are fantastic for are quick diagnostics. And Cas14, which was announced, I read about this when it was announced the last fall. Cas14 was in the news, and they said that this is notable because it's exceedingly small and very, very efficient. They were absolutely just amazed at just how tiny this was. They didn't even think it could do anything until they realized. They said, "Oh, let's see what it can do." And like, holy crap, this is really doing what other Cas genes are doing. It was clearly a little bit, more primitive, but it was still doing the job. So this means that they could, if it's so small, that means they can get into smaller cells or maybe even viruses, which would be fascinating. So together, Cas14 with 12 and 13, these are all kind of suited for these as complementary tools for fast diagnostics that are being developed even right now to deal with mutations, infectious diseases, even cancer. Now, the other more recent news item was Cas X. This was discovered by UC Berkeley scientists Jill Blanfield and Jennifer Duda. And Cas X is similar to Cas9, but it's much, much smaller. Not quite as small as Cas14, I don't think, but it's smaller than Cas9. Here's a good quote from Eugene Koonin, who studies evolutionary genomics at the National Institutes of Health. He says, in a sense, there's a race to come up with the smallest efficient genome editor so you can combine it with other things that you can pack into a viral vehicle for delivery inside a cell. He said, size is critical. It also looks good because it comes from bacteria not found in humans. So why would that be a benefit to a Cas complex that it's not from a human-derived bacteria? It's all about the immune reaction, right? Does that make sense?
That means we won't respond to it.
Right. It would have much less, or we would have a much less of an immune reaction than Cas9, because there are some worries about Cas9. And, it does come from human bacterial cells. So there could be some immune reaction potentially. But Cas X, its molecular arrangement is so different that researchers think it evolved on its own, completely on its own, with no common ancestor with Cas9. So thank you to convergent evolution, I suppose. The potential of CRISPR-Cas generically is off the hook. I mean, it's just such an amazing invention. One of the top discoveries inventions in decades. I don't think we can even fully imagine what we're going to be seeing in the coming generations. Now, our researchers have already used CRISPR to repair genetic diseases in animals, to sterilize mosquitoes, a huge story and fascinating story unto itself. They use it to make pig organs that are even more suited for human transplants. They're making beagles that are more muscular. It's a story. These advances are just one after the other. There's so many of them. So it's no doubt then that genetic databases are being scoured. Every stone is being overturned because there's so many possibilities for these Cas genes, and there's hundreds, if not thousands, of variants of these. Of even for Cas9, there's lots of variants, and there's hundreds of variants for Cas12 that haven't even been explored yet. So these scientists are incredibly optimistic. So now we've got, I've got a couple more quotes here. Benjamin Oakes, a former UC Berkeley graduate student. He's also the current entrepreneurial fellow in the Innovative Genomic Institute. He said Cas9's minimal size with no fat on the bone helps to clearly demonstrate there is a basic recipe that nature uses. Understanding this recipe will help us to better evolve and engineer genome editing tools for our purposes rather than nature's. So this is one of the reasons why smaller and smaller Cas genes are important, because once we know these minimal components, these minimal little machines within these proteins that can do these jobs and snip these genes, then we'll be closer to fully being able to engineer them ourselves. Jennifer Duda is a UC Berkeley professor of molecular and cell biology. She said, "We aren't just looking to uncover the next pair of molecular scissors. We want to build the next Swiss Army knife." To me, that's one of the big advances that we'll see in CRISPR in the coming years, not just uncovering these other evolved Cas genes, but also ones that we create completely from scratch. Those are the ones that we could optimize to do exactly what we wanted to do, instead of taking what nature has already evolved and trying to subvert it to our uses.
A couple points at this point. So first of all,
sure,
a lot of the Cas proteins are being discovered in archaea, not just bacteria.
Well, that's Cas14 was from archaea, right?
Yeah, that's right. Some of the smaller ones, because archaea tend to be smaller than bacteria.
Archaea are microorganisms like bacteria, but they are so diverse, they are so old, mm-hmm. and their metabolisms are so bizarre that they basically said, "All right, you're not bacteria anymore. You are your own thing, your own domain of life, archaea," and they are just absolutely fascinating.
Yeah, but I think trying to wrap my head around this as much as I could, this week in preparing for this, it really is helpful to think about CRISPR as a system. I like the Swiss Army knife idea, because it really is that you basically have the core of it is the CRISPR itself, which is essentially the ability to target a specific sequence of DNA.
Right.
Then you
That's
have
the bottom line.
Then you have the different Cases, which do different things. Some of them will cleave single strand DNA. Some will cleave double-stranded DNA.
Yep.
Some will cleave
RNA. Yep.
Yeah. They have different levels of specificity. Some are indiscriminate and will just cut things to shreds. Others will make one tiny little cut. Some will make a jagged separation versus a straight separation. So there's different tools that we could adapt to different purposes. But if you're doing genetic engineering using this system, you need to have another piece, which is the repair, where you insert the new bit of DNA and then you repair the whole thing. So what the CRISPR is really allowing you to do is to decide where to put that, because essentially the CRISPR will say, all right, we're going to make the SNP here, and then you can insert your gene there and repair it there. So it allows for the targeting along the DNA of where you want the insertion to take place. Again, it's this big, complicated, ultimately at the end, system with these basic components.
Oh, sure. Steve, did you find that they also have what's called CRISPR base editing? They're not even cutting the genome anymore. What they do is they basically take a base pair and they flip it into another base pair.
Yeah,
there's like no cutting. That is specific.
And just today, Bob, I came across anti-CRISPR protein.
Yes, I saw that too.
So these
what does that mean?
These block the cutting of the Cas protein. So
yeah, man.
This is basically a way of turning it off. These may allow us to have greater control, right? Whoa. So that you can decide where it cuts, and then to stop it from cutting, maybe to reduce off-target cutting or to at least turn it off once you've accomplished your goal. We're learning more and more and more of these bits of this evolving system, and we're going to be able to really customize CRISPR systems to do specific things. As Bob said, some will be better for diagnostic uses, others for therapeutic uses, and others for, you know, genetic engineering uses in humans and plants and other, in whatever other critters. So it really is this powerful tool. And the other thing is, we are still on the steep part of this curve.
Oh God, yes,
man,
God, yes.
This is like a disruptive technology. Because it also, because it's so cheap and fast compared to what came before it.
Any lab can do these experiments, Steve, right? I mean, you need so little money. Oh, my God.
I know. We are in the middle of this story. We are, I don't think, near the end of this story. They're developing catalogs of proteins. They're going to be able to just pull things off the shelf, you know, and make a customized CRISPR system to accomplish whatever it is you need to do. It's just amazing.
Oh, yeah. It's the next 20, 30, 40 years are going to be amazing, to just watching this one technology. I like, of course, me being Bob, I like to think of, what are we going to see with this? I think people alive today are going to see major genetic diseases fall one after the other with this technology. And who knows? It might not even take that long just to start seeing that happen. And I think even before that, we could see things like designer babies and intelligence augmentation drugs being like major election year issues. You know, you think we're going to talk about some wacky stuff in 2020, but how about the, elections in 10, 15, 20 years? We're going to be talking about some crazy stuff. And I think some of it's going to be related to CRISPR, because we're going to have major bioethical, decisions to be made. Like, how much do you want to design your baby? How much do you want to do things like augment your intelligence or extend your lifespan? Or, the low hanging fruit are obviously the diseases. But after, once that's done, we're going to have to answer these other questions. What do we want to do as a culture? What are we going to allow? It's going to be a fascinating time.
All right. Yeah. We don't have time to get into that question, though.
It's a little teaser.
Well, all right, we're here in 20 years, Steve. We'll talk about it.
Yeah, we'll talk about it again in 20 years. All right, Jay, it's Who's That Noisy Time. You promised us a really good reveal this week.
I did. Okay, last week I played this noisy.
That's the legal disclaimer at the end of those car commercials. Yeah.
That's right. So we had the worst guest. I have like categories here. Not the worst guest. Probably my favorite guest of the week was sent in by Ranny Montero. And he said, I think the noisy this week sounds like Beavis when he's turning into Cornholio. If you don't know what that is,
oh my God.
Look up, just go on YouTube and look up Beavis Cornholio.
Hey, the great Cornholio. I need to pee for my bunghole.
Wow, Karen.
I miss Beavis and Butthead. So
they're still relevant.
The next guest was sent in by a listener named Cliff Hansen. And Cliff sent me in the same noisy that I looked up when I heard this noisy, to be explained very soon. But I just wanted to put that out there. Thank you, Cliff. That was you and I were totally on the same page. Do you guys remember the young girl from last week named Scarlett?
Mm-hmm.
She guessed that this one was a computer reading the digits of pi very quickly. I thought that was really a neat guess.
Cool,
I like
guess.
That.
That's a great guess.
Andrew guessed, hey guys, I love the show. I'm pretty sure the noisy this week, you ready? Because this is the winner. Here's the reveal. Is a guy speaking what he claims is an alien language.
Mm-hmm. Oh, God.
He claimed to be able to speak multiple extraterrestrial languages, but I believe the clip is supposed to be Venusian.
Yep, Venusian.
Oh. Yes, so
creatures from Venus.
Yep,
it's so easy to test that. He's like, all right, say good afternoon, whatever,
again,
blah blah blah.
Yeah.
Do it again.
Yeah, it again.
And he's like, wait a second.
And now also, didn't Plutonian sound a heck of a lot like Venusian to you?
Oh yeah, there's some.
It's a dialect.
So the guy.
Also, I should point out that since this guy said he was from Krugar B.
Yeah, no, that was another language he spoke.
Yeah,
that's
I know
legit.
That.
That's legit though.
But it turns out that Krugar B is a sun, not a planet.
Oh, no.
Yeah, but I did look it up, and Kruger exists, because I was wondering if he just made that up out of whole cloth, but apparently he did a little research. So other things in the video. So this was a video called One Pair of Eyes. It was a series that was on, was it from 67 to 84? And I just thought, I watched a few of the programs. This is a great video for skeptics, or a great old TV show for skeptics to watch, because the purpose of this, of the show, was to illustrate people's different perspectives or views on certain topics. So that, you know, they're talking to basically weird people that have weird ideas. I thought it was really cool. I just liked, you know, it's an old show. It's got a really old feel to it. The guy that hosts the show, his haircut is insane, which has to be mentioned. Yeah, he's awesome.
Let me say one quote from Moore, which is important. It struck me about this show. He said, "The independent thinker is a genuine, well-meaning person who is not hidebound by convention and who is always ready to strike out on a line of his own, frequently, though not always, in the face of all the evidence." So he is defending people like this guy for being an independent thinker. And we hear that a lot from the pseudoscientists and cranks. But the thing is, it doesn't keep you from also being profoundly wrong.
That's right.
Yeah. That's the important thing. Just, yeah, yes, you are going against the convention. Yes, you are being independent, but you could still be completely wrong. Right. But they often act as if, like, well, I must, what I'm doing is valuable because it's different. No, not necessarily. It just, sometimes it's just, you're different because it's dumb and no one else is dumb enough to do that.
But it is funny, and we don't know for sure if the guy's a scam artist or not. You know, it is something to hear, because there's novelty in what he is professing. You know, this guy is literally saying he's speaking to and receiving wavelengths from aliens that are teaching him the languages and stuff. I would tend
it's
to
not
agree
that
with
different,
you.
Right, from a guy who says he can speak in tongues. Well, kind of sounds the same to me.
Let's hear that. There's no difference.
Wow, that was speaking in tongues?
That's tongues.
Wow.
Wow. Yeah, it's the same.
Seemed like it had some structure to it.
It's like, it's just the gibberish that we can come up with by virtue of, because these are probably all English language speakers, so they have all the percussive speech of the English language, and they're just going.
That was a fun one. I really enjoyed the research and watching the video and learning more about, like, what that guy was getting at. You know, at one point he was writing the languages out, and to me it just looked like he had practiced doing some complex scribbling. And again, all you have to do is say, "Could you write that again?" You know what I mean? What does that say? Okay, could you write that on another piece of paper? And, oh, you know, it's not the same. I'd love to hear his explanation for that.
So that's like the golden tablets, right?
Yep.
And yes. Monet. We know all about those.
Yeah. Mm. The translation where they lost the translation, he had to retranslate it. It was slightly different. He's like, well, he had some hand-waving explanation for why the second time around the translation wasn't exactly the same.
Of course.
Mm-hmm. So a listener named Jack Davidson sent this one in. Yeah. So that was a cool one. There, I could hear lots of different things that could be in this noisy. If you heard a cool noisy this week, or if you think you know what this noisy is, email me at WTN@theskepticsguide.org.
All right. Quick name that logical fallacy. This is a letter I got from a physician, actually. And they write, "I am a 75-year-old doctor currently enjoying my first world cruise with my husband. And although I came away with plenty of books on my Kindle, a reading course for classic Greek and a Rubik's Cube to learn, I couldn't help but pick up your book in the ship's library." How cool is that?
Ship's library.
Wow, that's awesome.
"I am a retired anesthesiologist, so have a modicum of intelligence, and I'm really enjoying the book, but I am missing the mathematical proof behind some of your statements, which I have no cause to distrust. I wonder if you have written some of these out as people may make inquiries. As an example, I cite the problem of the chances of 23 people in a room having the same birthday. It's a long time since I did the mathematics of probabilities at school. And I immediately want to say that it's 1 out of 365 times 1 out of 365. But I instinctively feel I am missing something, and that it is about all the others having independent birthdays. The answer of the probability being 1/2, I cannot see yet. Can you help me here? As I mentioned, the setting out of the mathematics would help me and probably others enormously. With kind regards and eager expectation of an answer in the fullness of time."
Aw, what a formal letter.
Yeah, I know.
I love that.
What mistake is she making here? So again, the point
for doubting us, first of all.
I'm kidding.
So for background, in case anyone out there doesn't know, we did publish a book in 2018, The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. The sales are going well. If you haven't checked it out, we encourage you to do so. One of the chapters, we do mention this as a quick example of the fact that people have very bad intuition about statistics, and the emailer is proving my point. We have a very intelligent person who just can't wrap their heads around this example. This derives from this demonstration of our statistical ineptitude that if you say, how many people would you have in a room for there to be approximately a 50% chance that two of them have the same birthday? Most people guess a much higher number than the real number, which is 23, which seems counterintuitive. You have 23 people together, there's a 50-50 chance that two of them will share the same birthday? The answer is yes. Her intuition is telling her it's 1 out of 365 times 1 out of 365.
Right.
And we actually mention in the book what logical error that specific assumption is. Do you guys remember what it is?
Oh, yeah, you're right, Evan. That's got to be the lottery fallacy, right?
Yeah, that's
what
exactly.
I was thinking.
That's the lottery fallacy. So she's calculating the odds of two people having a specific birthday. Two specific people having a specific birthday.
Right. August 14th.
What are the chances that these two people were born on August 14th? That's the odds that she's calculating. So like when people win the lottery, you think, what's the chance that that guy won that lottery? The question is, what's the chance of any two people in the room having any birthday that overlaps? And so that's very different. So first of all, the chance of two people having the same birthday is 1 in 365, right? Because it doesn't matter what the first person's birthday is, just the second person has to match the first person.
Right.
But then if you add a third person, they could match either of the first two, right? And then the fourth person can match any of the first three and so on. You have to add all of those probabilities up.
And exactly. So she was confused because she was saying you would take 1 out of 365 and multiply it by 1 out of 365 because she was trying to get to the 50% chance. And so how do we go from 1 out of 365 to 26 people?
No, it's 23 people. So if you have 23 people in a room, the chance that any two of them will have the same birthday is about 50%. So if you guys remember, we did this
at the extravaganza in New York City.
We did it a few times, but we did it a little bit differently. What we did was we would start with the first person in the front row and say, what's your birthday? Mm-hmm. All right. Then we'd go to the second person and say, what's your birthday? And we'd keep going until two people had the same birthday. And we never got past 11 people.
Yeah. It was well short of 23.
Well, yeah. But the thing is, 23 people is just at 23, there's a 50-50 chance.
Right.
But those two people don't have to be the 23rd person in somebody. You know what I mean?
Right. Yeah.
So it could just happen to be the first person and the seventh person, maybe the two people in those 23 that have the same birthday. So you have to calculate the odds differently. And our experience was that, you don't get through that many people before two people have the same birthday. And it is very counterintuitive just because we suck at statistics. But
she's saying, what's the math to get there?
Yeah, though that is, I'm telling you the math. You just have to calculate out the probability of, you have to match every possible permutation of comparing everyone to everyone else. You know, with that 1 in 365 chance, you have multiple chances of, it is, if you have two people, it's 1 in 365. But if you have multiple people, you have to add that probability of everybody to everybody else.
And I have seen the math done on the internet, you know, obviously there's websites that'll explain it and draw it out for you, how you arrive at that.
That's the math, but you could spell it out, in detail. So, but it is interesting to think about the specific error she was committing was the lottery fallacy and confusing specific probability with general probability of, you know, this specific person winning versus anyone winning.
Sure. That was one of my very first skeptical lessons. And I think, Bob, you were the one who told it to me back in the 90s.
Yeah.
when we talked about the lottery itself. It's like, what are the odds of a person winning the lottery twice? Well, it's what are the odds of Evan Bernstein winning the of the lottery twice are remote and in the billions. But anybody, any person, what are the chances for anybody winning a lottery twice in their lifetime? One in 30?
Near 30. Yes, yeah, that's, yeah.
It should happen.
As a law of large numbers.
Once every couple of years in the world, and it does. It actually happens exactly as often as you would predict by statistical probability. All right, guys, let's move on with science or fiction.
Oh, boy.
It's time for science or fiction.
Each week, I come up with three science news items or facts, two real and one fake. And I challenge my panel of skeptics to tell me which one is the fake. We got no theme, just three regular news items this week. You guys ready?
Yes.
Yes, yep. Kara especially.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
All right, and away we go. Item number one, a new study finds that bees are able to learn how to add and subtract. Item number two, scientists have demonstrated for the first time echolocation in a species of moth. Item number three, researchers have found that antibiotic-resistant genes can move from temperate regions into soil bacteria, even in remote Arctic regions, in as little as 3 years. Bob, I don't believe you've gone first in a while.
Okay, so let's start with that last one, the antibiotic resistance. Yeah, I'm just not going to put any limits on bacteria in this game. So yeah, that is amazing. That in 3 years, soil bacteria in the Arctic, I mean – wow. But bacteria are awesome. Archaea, too. Let's look at the second one here. First time echolocation in a species of moth. Sure. Why not? It's a moth. The first one I got a problem with. A new study finds that bees are able to learn how to add and subtract. I think that's a little bit too sophisticated for bees. It's amazing. A bee brain is about as big as that little tiny ball at the tip of a pen that kind of spins around and picks up ink and writes it on the paper, that little tiny, tiny ball that you probably can't even barely see, that's how big a bee brain is.
I don't think bees actually have brains.
Well,
they have clusters of neurons.
Ganglia.
Yeah, they have ganglia.
Yeah, ganglia cluster, whatever.
Like a cortex.
Brains-ish.
No, I didn't say cortex. It's brainish.
There's no talking during science or fiction.
All right.
It's brain-like. It's brain-like.
Brainish.
So it's, whatever it is, it's tiny as hell, but they can do amazing things. But adding and subtracting, I don't think that's been found. I'll say that's fiction.
Okay, Kara?
I feel like there is numeracy to some extent in animals. I don't know. Adding and subtracting is very different from, like, multiplying.
Differential calculus.
I don't think bees can do differential calculus. And we knew that, like, clever Hans wasn't that clever, and he wasn't really doing math. That was Hans, right? Yeah.
Clever Hans.
Hans, I apologize. Oh, Hans. He wasn't actually doing math. He was taking cues.
Unconscious cues, yeah.
Yeah, but that doesn't mean that there isn't some innate ability in many creatures to be able to, like, see more versus less. I don't know. When you say to add and subtract, like, I don't know how specific this is. Like, is it 1 + 1 is double that? Because I think all animals can figure that out. Echolocation and moths? This one I don't believe at all. You have to have ears to echolocate, don't you? You have to, like, make a clicky sound and then hear it. I think you have to be able to hear it to echolocate. I don't think moths can hear. Maybe they can. I know that there are obviously a lot of insects that create noises. Some of them are mating cues, so they must be able to hear each other. But I don't think that those clicks are to know where they are in space. I mean, they have antenna. They have all these other, I don't know. I don't think moths can echolocate. That one bothers me. But I am going to go with Bob on the antibiotic-resistant genes. I am, like, always angered and frustrated, but never surprised when I read new studies about how fast-reaching antibiotic resistance is. Because, as we know, it's not the actual bacteria. It's the genes. And those genes are swapping all the time. So, I don't know. I'm going to differ from Bob, and I'm going to say it's the moth one, and it's probably going to bite me in my echolocating ass.
Okay, Evan.
Well, I think I'll agree with both Kara and Bob on the antibiotic-resistant genes. But the other two, okay, so echolocation in moths. Now, I have a vague recollection that we've talked about echolocation concerning moths on the show before many years ago, but I thought it was in the context of moths being able to block echolocation in a way, like in bats, I think. I think they were a deterrent, or they disrupted the echolocation. So it would be, I guess, really strange to find out all of a sudden, first time discovering that, oh, wait, they're doing echolocation as well. So that one's not really ringing right with me for some reason. Whereas the one, when I read this one, how you wrote it, Steve, about a new study finds that bees are able to learn how to add and subtract. What I'm thinking here is that bees as a collective, as a hive mind, in a sense, you know, like an army of ants, sort of all kind of beat to a similar drum in a community.
Nope, this is individual bees.
Thanks. It is individual.
Whoa. Individual bees.
An individual bee. That's remarkable. They're both striking me as wrong. Something is striking me more wrong about the moth one. I think there's because I'm hung up on this news item. I think we talked about 10 years ago. So I'll go with Kara. I'll say it's the moth one with echolocation. I don't think that's right.
Okay, Jay.
All right, so the one about the bees. I mean, I think if I am guessing correctly here, you know, the adding and subtracting, I would imagine, isn't like this conscious thing, because who the hell knows how conscious those insects are. I think that they, something about them being able to determine like where the most flowers are and stuff like that, and it probably happens in their head where they can figure out like not only the best places to go to gain the nectar that they want or the pollen that they want, but they can communicate that back to the hive. So I think that one's science. The second one here, I agree with what you guys said. I was thinking to myself while listening, you know, the moth, even though we can't really hear the echolocation of what bats are doing without, you know, amplification and you know, using equipment. I've heard little screeches and things like that, but, you know, to really hear what they're doing, that takes some studying and equipment. I don't know if moths would be able to make enough volume to even help them. Moths aren't looking for the same things that bats are. Bats are looking for moths. Bats are looking for insects to eat. Like, I don't know what moths eat, to be honest with you. They probably drink some stuff. I don't know what they eat. I don't know. It's funny to think about it. But they, I don't think they need it, so I don't think that one is science. And the last one, complicated, and I don't know what to say about that, so I'm going to just stick with my gut. Second one, the middle one, the moths.
The moths are fiction. Okay.
That's correct.
Hmm.
So you all agree with three, so we'll start there. Researchers have found that antibiotic-resistant genes can move from temperate regions into soil bacteria, even in remote Arctic regions, in as little as 3 years. You all think that one is very depressing science.
Mm-hmm.
And that one is science.
Yeah, baby. Go bacteria.
So yeah, they were very surprised. They were surprised, and they were looking at soil bacteria in like the remote regions of Svalbard, Norway, and in the Arctic region. And they said they were not expecting to find any resistant genes there, but they did, and they found ones that had been previously detected, like in India 3 years previously, as like the New Delhi gene. So these are specific genes that they knew about. So yeah, that's really depressing that the resistant genes can spread so quickly. Some like with multi-antibiotic resistance, like super bacteria. That does not bode well for the longevity of our antibiotic regimen. Let's go back to number two. Scientists have demonstrated for the first time echolocation in a species of moth. Before I answer this one, let me point out a couple of things. So moths do make sound. They can vibrate their wings very fast to produce like a humming noise. And Jay, they wouldn't necessarily need to use it to find prey. They could use it to find and evade predators.
Mm-hmm.
Or even to navigate. So just because they're not hunting little insects doesn't mean they have no need for echolocation.
Okay.
You should have realized that.
Well, you know, I was given a very short amount of time, Steve.
Yeah.
You
had
the whole day. Yeah, only had more time.
But you know, I was hoping you would have realized that because this one is the fiction.
Oh!
Yes!
So Evan is correct. Evan is correct. They use this to jam the echolocation of bats.
I thought so.
Yeah. And this was just, this was inspired by another study where they found the same thing in a deaf moth. that even though the moth itself cannot hear, it does vibrate its wings to create a noise.
How do moths hear?
They can hear.
They must have.
But they don't have ears.
Oh, maybe tympanic membranes. Or
they have to have some kind
of. Maybe like on their thorax like or something.
Frogs don't have ears, but they can hear as well.
Can detect the frequencies. Okay.
So this is just extending that previous findings to this new species of moth that is known to be deaf. And the question was, would a deaf moth produce sound? You know, but it turns out that it does. Yeah, but multiple studies now in multiple species of moth, they found that they are jamming their echolocation, which is just cool to think about that. All of this means that a new study finds that bees are able to learn how to add and subtract is science. This is crazy. I can't believe I only got one of you on this. So numerical cognition in honeybees enables addition and subtraction. They had to train the bees. They had sent them through a maze to nectar. And they would swap up which direction, you know, the nectar was in, and they used color, either yellow or blue, in order to communicate to the bee whether they were supposed to do addition or subtraction in order to find their way to the nectar. Because again, they were moving the nectar around, so it wouldn't be just based on memory. So they were changing the details enough that the bees had to actually do addition and subtraction in order to find the nectar. They couldn't just remember previous times because the details were shuffled around. So that's what this study shows. And it took about 100 trials, I think they said, before most of the bees would get it. We'll learn to associate the yellow and the blue with their need to do addition and subtraction. I'm always, I always say you should be cautious when interpreting any kind of animal study demonstrating cognition because it's so hard to tell what kind of cognition the animal is actually doing to achieve the task that we set before them. They're trying to control for variables, but who knows how the bees are actually solving this problem. They're inferring that they're adding and subtracting, but it's got to be replicated. You got to shuffle the details around to really, really see is the adding and subtracting really consistent? But
It's funny that they're always smart enough to figure out how to solve the problem in an easier way.
Yeah,
they may be set out.
Exactly. They may be solving it in a way not that the researchers intended to model, but interpreted at face value, that's what this study showed. So that's why I said a new study finds this, but we'll see if it holds up. But it seems pretty robust. Again, I don't use studies that I don't believe as science. I think that the study itself is robust, but you never know if this kind of thing is going to hold up.
You never ever know.
Right. But that's interesting. Basically it would push the limits of what we would, in terms of this, bees obviously have a very simple nervous system compared to vertebrates. But there may be some algorithm in there that enables them to do some basic addition and subtraction. And Jay, you're right. I was thinking the same thing you were. It's like, don't they have to communicate fairly complicated information to their hive about the distance and location, the nectar, and maybe that
it's
algorithm.
It's all about the dancing.
Maybe whatever is happening in their cluster of neurons that enable them to do that also can be utilized to do basic addition and subtraction. I don't know, but that was the first speculation that occurred to me when I read this study. But very fascinating. Generally speaking, animals could do more stuff than we think they can. That's a good rule of thumb. But we have to be very careful in how we interpret the results of these kinds of studies. All right, Evan, give us a quote.
Now, this quote I'm going to read was said or written at least 50 years ago. So I want you to keep that in mind. It could have been as much as 60 or 70 years ago. We live in a world where, unfortunately, the distinction between true and false appears to become increasingly blurred by manipulation of facts, by exploitation of uncritical minds, and by the pollution of language. And that was written and or said by Arne Tiselius, Swedish biochemist who won the Nobel Prize in Chemistry in 1948 for his research on electrophoresis and absorption analysis, especially for his discoveries concerning the complex nature of the serum proteins.
This is why it's always so fascinating to look back at pseudosciences of 100 years ago, of snake oil products, of these kinds of statements because you realize how little things have changed. We think that this is all, oh, mm-hmm. God, this pseudoscience, it's all new, all the stuff that's happening. It's the same old crap that's been plaguing humans forever.
Right.
You know?
Exactly. Right. This could have been written last week.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So it's a good example. You're right,
Steve. I don't know if I should be reassured or discouraged by that. But
yeah. Well, we just need to be, you know, it on our game all the time. Is what it reminds us of. We can't let our guard down.
It is what it is. Yeah. But good quote. That's a good find, Evan.
Thanks.
All right. Well, thank you all for joining me this week.
God bless you, Steve.
Sure, man.
And yeah, until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by SGU Productions, dedicated to promoting science and critical thinking. For more information, visit us at theskepticsguide.org. Send your questions to info@theskepticsguide.org. And if you would like to support the show and all the work that we do, go to patreon.com/skepticsguide and consider becoming a patron and becoming part of the SGU community. Our listeners and supporters are what make SGU possible.